Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, now in depth on an America riven by conflict and chaos and climate disaster. Journalist Omar El Akkad's novel is titled American War, but he says he doesn't think of it as a book about America, and that makes a certain kind of sense. We'll talk about why. It's also a deeply dystopian novel in a time when many of us are drawn to dystopian stories, and I'm interested in his view on that. And I want to know about whether Mr. Akkad heard a soundtrack in his mind on this book that opens in the year 2075. So we'll talk about music as well. Omar El Akkad has reported on the war in Afghanistan and the Arab Spring for Canadian publications. His debut novel is titled American War, and he joins us today from Portland, Oregon. And Omar, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as I said, we're drowning in fictional dystopia. As you know, The Handmaid's Tale is back on television. And so here's my theory about why, and I really want to hear what you think. I feel like it's not because we anticipate the specifics of that dystopia coming to be. I feel like it makes us take stock of our ethics and our values today. What do you think of that?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I was having this conversation with a friend recently, and we were discussing this idea of dystopias as being concerned with the end. You know, there's sort of these extrapolations. You read 1984, and it's this kind of grotesque extrapolation of the surveillance state.
Right.
A similar situation with The Handmaid's Tale. But I think writers who venture into this world are much more concerned with the state of right now. You know, the extrapolation is necessary to say this is where we might go if this continues. But by the time your TV is watching you back, 1984 as a novel is sort of irrelevant. The point is to get at this right now before we get to the place where dystopia is no longer distinguishable from reality.
I'm really glad you brought up 1984 because you may know this, that they read the novel in London aloud all the way through.
That's right.
Yesterday. Yeah. So I wonder if the vision of dystopia in the rearview mirror from a novel like 1984 and the vision of dystopia in The Handmaid's Tale or in the novel that you've written, I mean, how different is the value when you're looking back and looking forward? Do you know what I'm asking?
I mean, first and foremost, the fundamental difference is that Orwell and Atwood are far better writers than I'll ever be. And so while I love being mentioned in the same sentence, it's worth noting that.
Okay, modesty noted here. Don't necessarily agree, but go on.
You're kind. Thank you. So I can speak for the construction of this novel. Everything in this book, all the major events, all the major elements are not figments of my imagination. They are things that really happened. They just happened to people who are very far away and people who don't have much of a voice. For example, in the novel, there are these things called the birds. They're basically unmanned drones that are flying over the secessionist southern state. And they're effectively analogs to modern day drones. If you live in Yemen or you live in Libya or you live in Afghanistan, that's not an abstract thing. That's not something that is fictional. And so really all I did was take things that I was seeing either in my journalism or just in my view of the world and passing them through this sort of deliberately grotesque lens. That's all I was going for. The idea of setting it in the future doesn't necessarily mean that I was trying to write a book about the future. I wasn't trying to write a futuristic novel by any stretch.
One of the things that you remind me of, the way you describe that, is journalism. This is really, I think, in some ways about the fact that journalism has not necessarily been able to keep up with the chaos. And when I say that, I mean not in the reporting, but in the context and in the what it means. And I feel that, oh my gosh, as a journalist, every single day, the velocity of the news means less and less time to reflect on what this means. And I kind of feel like you're touching on that too.
I mean, absolutely. I've been writing fiction for a long time, and I was a journalist for 10 years. And obviously those two things overlapped. And for me, journalism is by definition concerned with answers, you know, who,
right,
what, where, when, and so on.
Right.
And fiction for me sort of scratches the opposite itch, which is to say that I go into fiction to explore questions. You know, there are no answers in this novel. That wasn't what I was going for. And we just happen to live in a time where we have these overwhelming questions with no answers. I mean, the segment before this one on your show was concerned primarily with questions for which we have no definitive answers. That's mm-hmm. a very frustrating thing from a journalistic standpoint. But to me, it's the heart of fiction. It's the reason you get into fiction, is to ask questions for which there are no easy, definitive answers.
I'm not sure I agree with what you say, that there are no answers. There are no necessarily specific solutions in this mm-hmm. novel, but there's, I mean, the answer is, and I think this is something that one of your characters says at one point, this isn't a story about war, it's about ruin. That's the answer. Ruin comes if you ignore and dismiss a lot of the forces that are moving today.
Well, I mean, fundamentally, when I was writing the book, and whether I succeeded or failed is a different story. But what I was going for more than anything else was a defense of empathy. So in the novel follows the life of one central character, Surratt Chestnut. We meet her at the beginning when she's a young girl, and we follow her for the rest of her life. And by the end of the book, she is not a good human being. She is, in my view, fundamentally evil. And all I wanted to get at was this idea that you can understand why somebody does something mm-hmm. and you can explore their reasons for doing it without taking their side, without apologizing for them, without even liking them. And so to me, the purpose of the book was to get at a defense of empathy and the sort of ambiguity that kind of empathy often takes place in.
Why isn't it a story about America, given the title American War?
Almost everything in the book lives as a kind of analogy. You know, the central trick of the book was to take these conflicts that have defined the world in my lifetime. I'm talking about everything from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to the wars in Afghanistan, even the Arab Spring. You know, to take these conflicts or crises in which U.S. involvement has been either indirect or from a great distance, and recast them as elements of something very close to home, something from which it would be more difficult to look away. And the reason for doing that is to get at this idea that there is no foreign kind of suffering, you know, that revenge and suffering are universal languages. And so in my mind, setting it in the United States was a way to bring it close to home, but the story that I was trying to tell is much more universal than that.
Yeah, this is interesting that you call this the trick of the book, because I mean, typically Americans will look at somewhere like the Middle East and say, and not say, there but for the grace of God, right? They say there's something about people there, age-old conflict, you know, that we would not be engaged in. That's just not who we are. Maybe that's, you know, a measure of this idea of American exceptionalism, and that's a pretty shallow idea. What you've done is said, no, it could, just for lack of a better phrase, it could happen here, and here's how that might happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's an American trait in the sense that it's very exaggerated here. But I think it's more a trait of being on the privileged side of the earth, which is to say the privilege of not, for example, like Afghanistan, being on the losing end of a war for 30 straight years. Mm-hmm. You know, that allows someone in a peaceful part of the world to say, well, those people over there behave in a fundamentally different way. But I don't think there's any truth to that. I think the privilege of assuming that somebody on the other side of the planet reacts to injustice in some kind of fundamentally different way is just that. It's a privilege.
If you've just tuned into the conversation, I'm talking with novelist and journalist Omar El-Akkad. Omar, his new novel is called American War. And we're talking, as you hear, we started out talking about dystopia, how his journalism has informed his novel writing. Some of the ideas and ideals at the center of this novel. And for our listeners this morning, I'm going to come back to perhaps there's a reason that you feel drawn to this idea of dystopian literature today. As I noted, they're reading 1984 aloud, beginning to end, in London, The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood's wonderful novel, is back on television. What do you take away from reading that novel, and what do you think about what Omar and I said about why we're drawn to it? Here's a number, if you'll reflect on that, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, and you can tweet me on it. It's at Carrie NPR. I want to say one thing before perhaps we'll hear from some listeners on this idea of dystopian literature, but I remember having a conversation with Justin Cronin. I don't know if the passages with the zombies are, or maybe they're vampires, I don't know, is your kind of reading, Omar? But he wrote a trilogy on this, and it's so well done in its detail of the dystopian world. And I remember him saying it was the small details that he would get really anxious about. It wasn't the big overall scope of it. He worried that as he looked ahead into the future, that he was getting ahead of himself or behind himself. And I saw some of that in your writing, and I'd just love to know how you thought about it.
Well, every now and then I'm asked what books I was reading when I was writing this novel and which books influenced me. And the one above all else is a book called Let Us Now Praise Famous Men by James Agee. In the 20s, I believe, 20s or 30s, Agee was dispatched by a magazine to go to the South and do a story on Southern sharecroppers. And so he lived with three families for a long time. And he came back to the magazine, and instead of having a magazine piece ready for them, he gave them 500 pages. And they said, "We're not publishing this. This is insane. You spend 20 pages describing a bedroom. We can't do anything with this." And he ultimately published it as a book. And that reading that book, which is borderline unreadable in parts, but it was an education on the importance of the smallest things. You know, the shape of a doorknob, the grooves in a bed, you know. And it got me thinking a lot about the empathy required to address the smallest details with the same level of importance as you would the sort of bigger thematic issues. And I think that really influenced the novel a lot, is this idea of really getting into the granular and what the granular has to say about the human beings in whose lives these things exist.
That makes a lot of sense. And this might be a little too granular for you, but I want to say that some of these scenes where you're even describing the fauna of what this, in many ways, scorched landscape looks like, and then there's these kind of places of oasis. And it seems kind of simple, but your attention to that detail, I think there's a point where Sarah goes down to a creek, and you describe all the plants. I mean, she's talking about sweet gum seeds and black pepper vine fruit. And you have this sense of reading that moment that this isn't everywhere anymore. These are little crystalline places that most people will never see and that are ending. Am I putting too much importance in that? That's the moment. Those are some of the moments of the novel where I believed this landscape the most.
Well, thank you for that, by the way. There were certainly moments of the highest anxiety for me as a writer, because there were two levels of potential failure. The first was that I would get my research wrong, in the sense of, what kind of flora and fauna would exist in this part of the world. But on top of that, I had to cast forward, because the novel takes place about 60 years from now, and obviously climate change in the book has advanced in a very rapid way. And so to try and then weed out the things that would survive, the things that would survive the rising waters and the rising temperatures. And so there were two levels of potential failure there, and it made it quite a daunting task to try and invent the landscape of this world that takes place many years from now in a much harsher climate.
I think it'd be helpful if we talked about the maps that you've put into the beginning of the novel, because I think they'd give our listeners a sense of what America is like it starts out in 2075, and there are two maps, and the first one is the U.S. circa 2075, and then the other one is the Free Southern State circa 2075. So would you describe what the Free Southern State looks like in this map?
The Free Southern State is composed primarily of Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina. These are the states that decided to secede from the Union and spark the Second Civil War, which is the sort of thematic underpinning of the book. Atlanta is the capital of the Free Southern State. It should also be noted that not only in the Free Southern State, but in the entirety of the United States, the coastlines have been eaten away. Sea level rise has destroyed most of the eastern seaboard. Cities like New York, Washington, D.C. No longer exist. The capital has been moved inland to Columbus, Ohio. Florida no longer exists. So it's a very different country to begin with, and it's also a fractured one in the sense that there's now an entity in the southern edge of the country that is trying to secede.
And the Free Southern State, do I remember this right, that the Free Southern States seceded over the use of fossil fuels? Is that right?
That's right. So long after it would do any good at all, the federal government decides to impose a prohibition on fossil fuels as a way to combat the climate change and rising sea levels that have caused so much damage to the country. And even though by this point almost the entirety of the world has moved on to more sustainable fuel, a number of southern states decide that they would rather secede than go along with this prohibition, which is the sort of primary cause of the Civil War.
There's also a quarantine zone in South Carolina. Why?
Because that's where the fiercest fighting or the fiercest resistance to the Union takes place in the early days of the war. And so in Columbus, the federal government decides to try to figure out a way to sort of pacify the population. And they come up with this sort of virus. And its intended effect is to effectively calm people down. It's a pacifying agent, or at least intended to be. And of course, it's only after they release it in South Carolina that they discover that it's much more violent than that, and that it's passed on from generation to generation. And so what results is that the North quarantines South Carolina from the northern edge, and the southern state quarantines it from the other end. And what effectively it becomes a walled-off zone that nobody can get in or out of.
At the beginning of our conversation, you talked about how you were exploring the idea of empathy, especially within our lead character, who does some things that, as you said, can be considered evil. What's your sense about—now, this is not that far in the future, but what's your sense about how— our concept of humanity has changed along with this terrible environment that we're now in. Did you think about that?
So I started writing the book in the summer of 2014, and I finished the first draft almost exactly a year later. In fact, a few weeks before Donald Trump announced he was running for president, actually, was when I finish that first draft. Mm-hmm. Thematically, nothing has changed in the subsequent draft. So effectively, it's the same book, the same story. And it happens to be coming out, the book launched on April 4th of this year. Mm-hmm. So it happens to be coming out at a time when issues of polarization, even for a country as polarized as America is to begin with, are really sort of front and center. And, you know, when you write a book about the United States possibly starting a second civil war and you release it at a time like this, you know, it'll help sell a few more copies. And it'll be called, you know, prophetic or prescient, whatever words people want to use. But in reality, not only did I not predict any of this when I was writing the book, had I predicted everything that happened this year, had I predicted that perfectly in the summer of 2014 and wrote a novel based on that, I don't think there's a publisher in the country who would have gone for it. They would have said, this is too over the top. You need to tone it down. So, you know, I'll take any credit and I'll take the extra book sales. But no, it was never on my mind that we would be in this place when the novel came out.
If I might say this, though, I don't think you specifically answered the question I asked, which is, did you think about how our own concepts of humanity and connection would change in the kind of landscape you were creating? Now, I think we see evidence of that day to day here, but I wonder how much you thought about who we were as humans and how that was going to be affected, I guess, by this landscape that we're living in. In your book.
Oh, I'm sorry. You mean in the book? Okay.
Yeah.
I apologize.
Sorry.
I misunderstood the question. No.
Yeah.
What I needed was for human beings to remain the same way in terms of their capacity for empathy or lack thereof.
Right.
That was necessary for me because the future aspect of the book is, in my mind, irrelevant. You know, it's cast in the future, but it's set mostly in the free Southern state. And I deliberately wrote that part of the world to not feel like the future.
Got it.
I wanted to write about now. And so it was important for me that not change, that the human beings in this novel not fundamentally alter their view of other human beings simply because this is cast 60 years in the future.
A call here from Steve in St. Paul. Hi, Steve. What are you thinking about?
Talking about the changes when it comes to race, color, clothing, and how much of an inequality is sometimes placed on people because of those factors. I live in St. Paul. There's, of course, a large Somali community, and they dress totally different than people who've been born and raised here in this country, and of course they stick out. And people just kind of look at them a little strangely. And I'm just wondering how much that fits in with what she's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was writing the book, I had just moved to the United States. I'd moved to the United States the year previous. And I was just starting to get a sense of these kind of differences. And the closest I can come to describing the way I feel about it has to do with me personally, which is to say that I'm a Muslim man. I'm not particularly devout, but I consider myself a Muslim. I grew up in the Middle East. And in the current climate that we're in, that would normally subject me to an element of fear. I live in a city where a few days ago a white supremacist murdered two people because they tried to stand up to him when he was harassing two Muslim women. And so I think a lot about not only what it means to be, quote unquote, different in this country, but also visibly different, which is to say that I have much less to worry about because I sound the way I do, because I have the accent that I do, and also because I'm not a Muslim woman, for example, who's wearing a hijab. And so I think a lot about the outward appearance of human beings in this country and the massive fundamental extent to which it subjects them not only to this kind of otherness, but also to very real forms of violence. And certainly that influenced my thinking when I was writing this book.
Rob says on Twitter, dystopian novels show us the end result of certain ideas without our having to live them. Guess we didn't read enough of them. I asked you, Omar, through our producers here, if you were thinking about music, and you came back with a song to us that you think fits what the scope, the essence of the novel. What did you choose, and tell me why?
So I had chosen a couple of them. So I'm not sure which one you settled on, but there were ones that
we've got the London Grammar song. Yeah.
So in my mind, towards the very, very end of the book, there is a scene where effectively it's, in my mind, the climactic scene of the book. And it has to do with the sort of terrible events that are very plainly laid out in the beginning of the book finally happening. And the central character finally making her way to the capital of the United States. And that song plays in my head every time I see that scene. I'm one of these writers who sees – it's very visual for me when I think about the scenes in my book. Everything is seen. And that song always plays in my head. And there's a quietness about it, and there's that sense of the lyrics having something to do with I'm dreaming of you, and I'm going to force you to dream of me as well. That to me is a sort of defining aspect of the final climactic scene in this novel.
I mean, this is the scene where I think as a reader, I wanted Sarah to make a different decision, you know, and actually, Omar, I thought she would, but she doesn't. Mm-hmm. And this music... gives us a sense of that?
And when I was writing, when I started writing the book, I knew the beginning, which is to say the scene at the beginning of the first chapter where you see a little girl who's sort of playing on the porch of her home in southern Louisiana. And I knew the end. I knew what the end would be. Everything in the middle was a blur, but I knew exactly what the end would be. And I knew... that the end had to be it couldn't be nice, it couldn't be comforting. I wanted very much not to give a way out. And that's where the book goes.
Omar Al-Akkad will speak tomorrow night with Subtext Books, Matt Kelleher, at 7 o'clock at the St. Paul Athletic Club. Thank you for being with me today.
Thank you so much.
Beneath the moon. Tonight I'll be dreaming of...
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.